Last week, I talked about what might be, I think, what could be said to be the central teaching of the Buddha, the teaching about dukkha and the end of dukkha. And I clarified that teaching, pointing to how I think there's quite a bit of confusion about it. And I invited people to explore that teaching and practice. How many people brought some attention to the teachings about dukkha and the end of dukkha in the last week? That's great. Great to see the hands, because what I thought to do today is to continue with the theme about dukkha and the end of dukkha, but to expand it. Last time I talked about the basic meaning of the teaching, and I pointed to a number of ways to practice individually, to work with our own minds and hearts and bodies. And yet I think that the teaching is so fundamental that it really guides our practice in all the parts of our lives. So I want to today review fairly briefly what we covered last time and then expand that teaching about dukkha and the end of dukkha to include not just individual practice, but what we might call relational practice and collective or social practice as well. In other words, I think this teaching directs all the parts of our lives, directs, I should say, practice in all the parts of our lives. And it's, I think, remarkable by both its simplicity and its unifying power to give us perspective and to give us a sense of what's at the heart of our practice. Last time I asked the question that I really asked the question, what are we doing? You know, are we meditating to find calm? Are we trying to find peace? And last time I remember in the discussion, we did talk about how motivations for practice change over time. And I spoke about how, for myself, when I was first practicing, I had been influenced a lot by having some psychedelic experiences. And so I thought that the heart of practice was to have these far out experiences and to cultivate them. And when I heard some of the teachers talking about the end of suffering, which is how they translated dukkha, the end of suffering, I said, that must be for other people. Me, I'm not here to end suffering. I don't think I suffer that much. And I'm here for great, powerful, wonderful experiences. And having those thoughts was, as it were, tempting the gods and goddesses, because it wasn't too long before I found out that wasn't quite right and that I was capable of significant suffering. So I also suggested that there can be, and there often is, a lot of confusion. And again, I'll review some of the grounds for that confusion. A main ground is that the concept dukkha, usually translated as suffering, appears in the discourses of the Buddha with several meanings, not just one. And the first meaning might be translated by suffering. The first meaning is really that dukkha is pain. And last time I went through four meanings of dukkha, asking the question, does this meaning of dukkha give us a pointer to the meaning of the end of dukkha, which the Buddha says is the aim of practice. We also find that clarified in the Four Noble Truths. And my answer was that no, the first three meanings of dukkha don't help us understand what the end of dukkha is, what the aim of all the practice is, which is interesting. So I'll be brief here. The first meaning occurs in passages like where the Buddha speaks of birth being dukkha, illness being dukkha, old age being dukkha, death being dukkha. And here, dukkha means that which is painful. And that's the primary meaning that appears mostly in the text, and that's usually translated as suffering. But then it gets confusing because we can ask, does that kind of dukkha ever end? And the answer is no. There is pain as long as there is human experience. So we can be quite confused by talking about the end of suffering as the goal of practice without giving a very specific meaning to suffering. That's not the same as pain. The second understanding of dukkha that appears in the text is dukkha as the alternation from the pleasant to the unpleasant. That which is pleasant will not last. It will become at some point unpleasant. You know, the pleasant experience doesn't last, but again, that's a truism of all experience. So we don't understand the end of dukkha from looking at that kind of dukkha. And then thirdly, the third meaning of dukkha in the text is that dukkha is the fact that nothing of a conditioned nature can give lasting satisfaction. But again, that is simply a truism, which is an important teaching. And it's, you know, it's helpful for understanding what the end of dukkha might be, but it doesn't tell us, you know, this kind of dukkha never ends. So then I pointed to two teachings which I thought do help us understand what the end of dukkha is. I pointed to the teaching of the two arrows, which is that teaching in which the Buddha said, when we have a painful experience, it's like being shot by an arrow, which he called the first arrow. And everyone experiences that, but a practitioner learns not to do what a non-practitioner does. A practitioner learns not to shoot the second arrow. The second arrow is, we might say, the reactivity because of the first arrow, the reactivity because of the pain. You know, the blaming and judging, the tensing in the body that causes so much additional pain. You know, and, you know, I gave that example last time. For many types of chronic pain, the vast majority of the pain that's experienced isn't the original set of stimuli, but it's the contraction, the reaction to what's originally there. In other words, the second arrow. And I wanted to say that that second arrow we can call reactivity. It's the compulsive reactive pushing away of what's unpleasant. And then I generalize further by bringing in the teaching of dependent origination, and particularly the movement between contact and grasping. And I'll bring this up again. Okay, can you see this well now on the screen? Let's see. Can you see the image on the screen? Does it cover the whole screen? Okay, very good. So you can see this model. We have a further explication of, without using the term dukkha, of what this sense of dukkha is. We have contact through the senses is occurring every moment. It leads to a feeling tone, pleasant or neutral. Most feeling tones, the vast majority, are neutral, but some are pleasant and unpleasant. And when we are not fully mindful and we have habitual tendencies, we will want the pleasant and then grasp after it. And we will not want the unpleasant and we will push it away. And I said that this fourth stage we could call reactivity. In the teaching, it only focuses on grasping, but we can see there are really two types. There's the grasping, again, unconsciously, tending to be unconscious, compulsive, automatic. We grasp or we push away. And I want to say that that is what dukkha is. Dukkha is reactivity, and this is a fourth meaning, and we can really see very much, very clear in this teaching that the end of dukkha is the end of reactivity. It's the end of grasping and pushing away. Now, I wanted to immediately mention a really important complexity of the teaching, which is that I can be reactive and my reactivity can be caught up with something that's valuable, important, insightful. And that makes working with reactivity tricky. And, you know, I gave a few examples last time. I gave the example of I become very reactive when, let's say, my partner or my coworker doesn't keep an agreement. I become very reactive. It's unpleasant for me that that happened. I push it away reactively. Maybe I say nasty things. I have all sorts of thoughts. But there still is something important that I'm noticing. And the work with reactivity isn't about suppressing the whole show. It's not about simply saying, you know, I'm going to just squash my reactivity, not deal with it. Rather, what's called for is complex and can be challenging. It's to separate out the reactivity from the insight. Again, the other example I gave is insight is being very reactive about injustice. I can be very reactive about what happened, and it isn't about just squashing everything, and it's not about simply because I have something, as it were, right on my side, simply doing what I feel like. The practice, and this is really, we'll be pointing towards how we bring this into the social realm and the relational realm. The practice is to find ways to separate out the reactivity from what's helpful or insightful. And in a similar way, you know, I may, you know, the language is a little bit tricky, grasping and pushing away. What's being pointed to here is the compulsive, habitual, automatic quality, relatively. And I can, with some consciousness and without reactivity, as it were, go for what I want or try to prevent what I don't want. So you can see the complexities of this, right? We have, and the language is not totally adequate. So we have to remember that there is a distinction like that, that we, you know, that we can both want something and have that be skillful. I think Barbara last time in the discussion brought up the Buddhist concept of chanda, which it could be translated as skillful desire, you know. And again, pointing out the complexity helps us avoid some of the common misunderstandings of Buddhist practice as simply suppressing desire, right? Or not following what we want. It's more complex than that, right? So that's one of the challenges of working with dukkha. And then I spoke further about ways of practicing with dukkha and invited us to work with those. You know, I mentioned that if we're working with reactivity, an initial guideline for practice is to really be clear about the level of intensity. And the kinds that we can work with are in a range which is not overly intense. So I suggest using a scale like that of the Olympic divers, 1 to 10, and the kind of reactivity that we can work with in practice is maybe in the, you know, the 1 through 7 or 8 range, but maybe the 9s or 10s, things are too intense. The reactivity is too intense and we have to do other things with the reactivity. Maybe take a walk, do some heart practice like metta or compassion, talk with a friend, take a nap, whatever, you know, go dancing, something like that. So that's a really important guideline. I think I mentioned last time how initially, until not very long ago, most Buddhist teachers, you know, Western Buddhist teachers, when people were having traumatic reactivation, would tell them stay with it, which was not skillful. And as we've learned about trauma, I think we make more that distinction between the workable and the unworkable. So that's a first guideline. A second would be to have the intention to track for reactivity. You know, do that a few times a day. And I think, you know, many of us had that as an intention in the last week. We want to look for the reactivity. And sometimes we'll notice it just in passing. Sometimes it'll be small. You know, we can find that, you know, we are grasping, you know, food is an area for most of us where there's a certain amount of grasping, pleasant taste. We can look for that reactivity. And then thirdly, we can practice being mindful of the reactivity. Really study it. Study, get a list. What are my top 5 or my top 10 forms of reactivity? You know, what are the main ways that I'm judgmental of myself or others? And we can be mindful, look at the way they are in the body, look at them carefully, be conscious of them. We can, in the middle of the, you know, in the middle of practicing with reactivity, we can remember those teachings, the 2 arrows, the sequence from contact to grasping, they can guide us. You know, one way of practicing, I think I mentioned last week, is if we have something difficult happen, know that it's very likely that we'll shoot the second arrow. I have something difficult happen with someone else. I go through something hard for myself. It's very, very likely I will shoot the second arrow at myself or another or at both of us. And so giving oneself the guidance, watch out for me shooting the second arrow when I have something painful, difficult, unpleasant, challenging, is very, very good guidance. And then the last form of practice I suggested was to bring in the heart practices, to find ways of holding the reactivity with compassion, with loving kindness. To find way, you know, and we can work with a number of the heart practices, including forgiveness can be a very powerful practice. So today I want to go a little further and say that this teaching, I think, is so central that it can guide, really guide all parts of our lives and can be this very simple guide. You know, that we could express in very ordinary, simple English as my aim in all the parts of my life is to be skillfully responsive rather than reactive. Again, reactive in the sense of the compulsivity, the automatic, the unconscious quality. Again, noting that we have to be careful with the language because sometimes we can use the word react, but we don't mean that it has the quality of reactivity as I've been using it. So we want to, you know, we want to be clear about the language. And sometimes we use respond and react synonymously. So this is pointing to that compulsive quality, but we can, in all the parts of our lives, if we, again, if we have clarity about the terms, talk about being responsive rather than reactive. And so how to bring this into relationship? I think one of the things about our relational practice is that we, first of all, bring along our individual practice. And so in looking at how we work with dukkha and the end of dukkha in relationships, which I'm going to have to be fairly brief on, you know, we can first ask, what are the forms that reactivity take in my relationships? You know, and so in other words, what are the forms of grasping? What are the forms of pushing away? You know, am I possessive in some of my relationships? In my relationships, am I, you know, do I tend to really focus on what I want and not as much on what the other wants, right? And is there a kind of grasping in relational situations so that I, as it were, get my own way? You know, do I grasp after just having positive experiences? You know, am I in relationships conflict avoidant? That can be traced to a kind of reactivity. You know, a similar way, we want to look at what are the ways that I push away, you know, and these are sometimes easier to see. I push away people with speech. Someone says something I don't like or does something I don't like. I can be reactive in my speech. You know, very obvious point. You know, I think of a New Yorker cartoon, which I use a lot in teaching wise speech. It shows a woman sitting on a couch with what looks like a detective taking notes, standing behind her. And in front of her, there is a police officer. And behind the couch is what looks like a body with 2 feet sticking up. And she says to the police officer, "I misspoke. He misheard. Shots rang out." So is that familiar? That's very common, right, in our interactions. So we can be very reactive in our speech at times. We can not like something that's happening and be very reactive about it. We can be judgmental and blaming in all sorts of ways, maybe of ourselves, of others. You know, and again, there are complexities. A lot of our reactivity, especially in relational context, comes from residual material that often goes right back to childhood. So I recognize it in a way. I'm scratching the surface here, but when we want to practice with reactivity in relationships, we want to, you know, first thing is just to chart the ways that there is reactivity. And then how do we practice? One guideline that I like to use, which I work with in speech practice, is to say that in every relationship, there are at least five possible areas of spiritual practice. The first is I do my own inner work, let's say in this case with the reactivity. The second is I employ wise speech. The third is the other person does inner work. And the fourth is that the other person tries to utilize wise speech. And fifth, we collaborate together to talk about how we relate to each other with the aim of working with reactivity. All those five, if we have all those five together, that's optimal and wonderful relationships if that's occurring. But in every relationship, at least two of those are possible. Which are those two? the first two, right? In other words, the other person, whatever the other person does, I can do my own inner work, and I can also try to employ wise speech. And so this is where all the work that I mentioned earlier with reactivity, we bring into the relational context as well. You know, the mindfulness of reactivity, the working with heart practices, the remembering the teachings, and so forth. And then we also, I think, bring in our practice into the social context. And again, we do that by bringing in our individual practice. If I'm reactive about injustice, I can do my own inner work. And I think this is a core for activists. This is why I think it's so crucial to combine inner work and outer response. It's such a powerful combination, because without that, our social relationships, maybe our activism, our service, if we're not doing that, we can be reactive, and the reactivity actually is arguably not going to help the situation so much. You know, that it will tend to polarize things, we'll tend to demonize our opponents and so forth. And there's quite a, maybe let me back up first. What are the ways that we find reactivity again in social or collective situations? Pretty obvious, you know, when we relate to people with other views, other political views, other social views, we may be very, very reactive towards their views in the same way we may grasp onto our own views. Again, remembering all the complexities that having a view, we can have a wonderful view and I can still be reactive and grasp after it, right? So there are all these, you know, that complexity stays with these areas, you know, that again, I can have a very important observation, and that can be the basis for me being reactive with a friend, a partner, or, you know, with people with different views. So again, we want to track our different ways of being reactive in social, in the social realm, the collective realm. Again, it can be how we see others with different views. We can be very reactive about what happened. I can grasp after my own views, and so forth. And we can also see how actually at the social realm, and this is, I think, important, and not always seen, reactivity can be institutionalized at the social level, right? And that's very interesting. So, you know, some of you know the work of David Loy, who I think more than anyone else has talked in a very lucid way about how greed, hatred, and delusion get institutionalized. You know, and we could see that what we're calling greed and hatred are really other ways of talking about grasping and pushing away compulsively. And so David says our economic system institutionalizes greed in at least two ways. Corporations are never profitable enough, and people never consume enough. Many examples of institutionalized ill will spring to mind: racism, a punitive judicial system, the general attitude towards undocumented immigrants, and the plague of militarism in the 20th century and 21st century. He said in the 20th century, perhaps as many as 170 million people, most of them non-combatants, were killed. I mean, that's right. That's reactivity. Wars are reactivity gone amok, right? And so, but it's helpful to see that. It's helpful to have that social lens. One of the things that's, for me, been very remarkable, and I think I'll close with this. One of the things that's been very remarkable is that the Buddha's teaching about dukkha and the end of dukkha really maps on very precisely with the teachings from Gandhi and King about nonviolence. Nonviolent action, you know, which again can take place interpersonally as well as socially, I would say that nonviolent action is exactly the counterpart of non-reactive action. You know, that you find when you look to, for example, Dr. King's teaching, he says that the whole core of the teaching is that we don't injure others because of injury that we have received. He says we must follow a consistent principle of non-injury. We must refuse to inflict injury upon another. Another way of saying it, the means must be as pure as the ends. So there's a rejection of the philosophy of the ends justifying the means. And so, you know, we find this notion of non-harming also with the Buddha, of course, but we have that teaching of non-reactivity to guide social action on a large scale, you know, and I think it's really the counterpart. You know, we combine that social action with inner work, you know, that one only can really follow that kind of nonviolent action if one combines it with inner work. And we can see as we do that how this teaching that you know, the reactivity, for example, the reactivity that pushes away is based on some kind of pushing away of the pain. And we can see how, for example, hatred is so much a result of not dealing with pain. There's a very powerful line from James Baldwin where he says, "I imagine one of the reasons that people cling to their hates so stubbornly is because they sense once hate is gone, they will be forced to deal with pain." And we can see that when we look at the different forms of hatred and the reactive views in our country right now, so much of it, and this is where empathy and compassion can come in, so much of it comes from pain that gets manipulated by politicians and turned into ways to scapegoat or to blame, whereas the actual underlying pain is not dealt with. So again, I've been brief here, but I think you can see at least some of how we can take the fundamentals of the teaching about dukkha and the end of dukkha and have it guide us in not only our individual practice, but also our relational practice, and in this really crucial area of social and collective practice, the teaching can be applied and can give us ways of looking in a different way at our relational and social lives. So I think I'll end there and invite us just to pause for a moment and see what may have been resonant or helpful, and then we can open things up. So let me invite anyone who would like to share something or ask a question. And I also am quite interested in what people explored during the last week, any insights, and that'd be very appropriate to share as well. Something you learned about dukkha and the end of dukkha, about reactivity. So really any can go many places, including your own practice the last week, or a question, request for clarification, something to share. And I think I can see people, so you could either use the raised hand function or just raise your hand. Liz, do you have your hand up?
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
I haven't been around because I'm taking a 10-week course with the Center for Mindfulness and Compassion, which has been mind-boggling. And I just want to read a quote that I have from the Buddha, translated by, from the Samyutta Nikaya. "The whole world we travel with our thoughts, finding nowhere anyone as precious as one's own self. Since each and every person is so precious to themselves, let the self-respecting harm no other being." So this inner work that you mentioned is so tremendously important.
Yeah.
So that we can understand others, because most of what we feel and think is normal, and everyone else is feeling it also to some extent.
Yeah.
So in my work with self-compassion and folks, I try to normalize all of our feelings and thoughts, and working with that. First of all, that it's human. We all feel the same things to some extent, and definitely working with self-compassion for me has been mind-boggling. Really, what do we do with our pain?
That's right.
How can we work with it? And also to understand that everyone else feels this at other times. So I love this. Since each and every person is so precious to themselves, let the self-respecting harm no other being. To understand that everything we feel is human and normal, and others are going through the same things, and we need compassion for ourselves and for them.
Yeah, thank you, Liz. Thanks for that passage. You know, that is sometimes quoted or sometimes translated a little bit differently, and the last lines are sometimes translated as, "One who loves oneself will not harm another," which again very powerfully points to the inner work. The kind of the correlate of that is that very often those who harm another don't have self-love.
Right.
You know, that if there's true self-love, one can't harm another. And of course, so we look for what blocks self-love, and then we can see that those who harm others often have some deep underlying pain related to a lack of self-love. You know, I remember reading a study of the of violence committed by young people, and they found the greatest correlate for of youth violence was that violence had been done against them, right? And so there's a whole, you know, dynamic there that's really crucial. Thank you. Looks like, is it, am I pronouncing your name right when I say Kylie, or is it?
Yes, Kylie. Thanks, Donald.
You're welcome, thank you.
You're really enjoying this. And this is a question that I had over from last week too. In terms of, you know, doing our inner work, and I'm just wondering what you think sometimes, you know, what you think the role of acknowledging our conditioning plays when we're doing that work. Sometimes it feels like I can just get stuck in conditioning, and it's hard to move forward from that. I'm just wondering, you know, I know there's a place for it, but, you know, when does it become more of an obstacle in terms of moving forward?
When does our conditioning become an obstacle, or when
acknowledging our conditioning, and, you know, because like everything can be brought back to conditioning in terms of reactivity.
Yeah,
and sometimes it feels like when I'm making that pause and doing the U-turn, it's like conditioning is everything. It's
are you meaning like social conditioning or conditioning that occurred when I was young or
all of it?
Yeah. I think thanks to neuroplasticity, all the conditioning can be worked with. We don't so much get rid of our conditioning, but we develop new patterns or new habits. So that's the good news. You know, like when I work with people with the judgmental mind, we often trace being judgmental back to very old conditioning, particularly the most chronic ones, such as forms of self-judgment, you know, can be traced back often to childhood, right? And so understanding that conditioning and acknowledging it is crucial. And yet we also can realize that they're very old patterns. We may have repeated them, 5 to 100 million times. They gain a little bit of power, but alternatives are possible. That's again where it's helpful to really even use the model of developing new neural pathways. So we want to see the conditioning. We may use the language of conditioning. We may use the language of habits or habitual tendencies. Seeing that and developing alternatives is right at the heart of this, right? Because then that's what our practice is. Our practice is about interrupting conditioning. That's a way to talk about it. Yeah. Does that get at it some, Kylie? Yeah, thanks. Anyone want to share from the last week anything you found? Again, you can just raise your hand. I can see everyone and acknowledge people. Yeah, it looks like Mary, please.
I just wanted to say I really appreciated the suggestion about putting a kind of numerical value on one's dukkha.
Yeah.
Number one, that just was very helpful because definitely, you know, in general, the dukkha I experience is pretty mild. It's not all that, but it was helpful having that kind of distinguish, and then just even being okay, like what is this level, and then being able to think, all right, then now what do I do with it?
Yeah,
So just even having a numerical kind of categorization then almost softened it and cooled it down real quickly.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the reactivity gains power by not being seen. Right? And even in just saying what the level of it is at that point, even if the reactivity is happening, maybe we have 20% where we're not in it. We're 20%. Okay, let's make a numerical assessment. and then we can bring mindfulness to it. So, even that's an additional benefit. You know, the main purpose of having that was to look out for the really intense ones. But you've really pointed to another benefit that can give some perspective and bring up immediately the question, what's a skillful response? And again, that's we always say that actually our practice is not so hard, but remembering to do our practice very hard. Interesting. Yeah. Thanks, Mary. Was that complete for you? Okay. Yeah. Maybe time for one more if there is one. Again, I would love, Corey, please.
I sometimes when I'm listening to things, I'm following the thread of what's really resonating with me. And then I miss like the next couple of sentences. Okay. And so you were talking about these five different ways that you can work with it in relationships and, you know, the two that we can control. And I've completely lost the thread of the other three.
Oh, well, I was saying that this was more, I can do my inner work. I can do my, relational work, particularly with speech. And then the third and fourth, where the other person can do the same. And then fifthly, we can be collaborative. You know, we could talk together, as I'm sure so many of us do, and say, when you said that, that, you know, we can talk about it maybe non-reactively. When you said that, I, you know, gosh, I felt my, you know, my unworthiness conditioning coming up. And, you know, I went there and I got kind of reactive. And, you know, let's maybe when that happens again, I'll try to take a pause. You know, that could be it, you know, or just stop for a little while, you know, and we try to collaborate together. So those are the five. And that's partly bringing it up to point to the fact that no matter what the other person is doing, because if we're blessed to have a relationship in which all five are happening, that's awesome, right? But a lot of our relationships, the other person is not practicing. And we often think, oh, that's happening, I can do whatever I want. But it's always valuable to keep our own first two forms of practicing going, no matter what the other is doing. Kind of like unilateral disarmament. Yeah. Does that help, Corey? Yeah. Okay. Well, I could stay and talk for another hour about this, because it's, you know, it's the teaching dukkha and the end of the dukkha is such a simple unifying teaching. And it also, like I say, isn't always presented in a clear way. So that we actually, I even think that using the words, I don't use the word suffering anymore in talking about Buddhist practice. Yeah. For a while, I used to have a technical distinction. So I said there's a difference between pain and suffering, and suffering is the reactivity. But I've stopped using even the word suffering, because in ordinary English, it's ambiguous. Sometimes it's synonymous with pain. So anyway, thank you for listening. And let's go to the meta cards, and then we'll have our closing.